Hello and welcome back to Willosophy. I am Will Anderson. I am the host of the show. This is a podcast, if you've not listened before, that I started about a year ago. In fact, over a year ago. My first guest was Todd Sampson, who you're going to hear today. This is the old episode, the first original episode of Willosophy. But if you've just started listening to the podcast, maybe you'll listen to the first episode already with John Safran. If you have not, go and check that out. It's a really fabulous episode about his amazing book. Please read his book. I'm not going to bang on too much here at the start. I'll explain more as we go on. But basically, just to cut to the chase, last year I started this podcast, Willosophy. I wanted to talk to interesting people about whether they had a philosophy of life or love or work or anything, and if that philosophy had changed and how they applied it to their life. That was kind of the aim of the podcast. And we did a few episodes and then it stopped. And it stopped for a couple of reasons. It stopped because I was on the road and it was almost impossible for me to get guests for it. My other podcast, Tofop, if you've not checked that out, T-O-F-O-P, is a more comedy podcast, and it was easy for me to get comedians on the road and do that regularly, but it was hard for me to get guests for this. The second thing was, as I explained a couple of times, and you'll hear it kind of unfold as the episodes go on, and that's normally how I like to explain things. I don't want to have some grand sweeping generalization of what this podcast will be. It will be different things for different people, but I also will explain it to you as I go because my mind changes on it. So what I've done is I've put up the first episode. That's the new episode. What I'm going to aim to do this year is put up regular episodes, but I would like it to be a balance of male and female guests. That's just one of my aims for the year. You'll hear a little bit of why. That's one of my philosophies unfold through the podcast. So basically with new episodes, hopefully we'll have an even balance of male and female guests. That's one of the things I'm aiming to do. However, I just thought, you know, because people wanted to hear the old episodes, or maybe you're new to the podcast and you'd like to hear the old episodes. So I'm going to put all those episodes up now. So we've got one new episode with John Safran. We'll put up all the old episodes. And then from then on, we'll have a pretty even balance after that. So I just wanted to explain that. It will also make sense because I have a conversation with Lauren Freed at the end of it about the fact that I'd only had male guests up till then. So I thought for that conversation to make sense, then I would put all these ones up in order. You can download them, you can listen to them, you can kind of see what happened. The other thing I was going to say is I haven't changed these episodes. So I put some music at the start and each of them will have a little introduction, I imagine. But other than that, I've left them unchanged. So now that I've put some music in, you'll hear conversations with me saying that we don't have any music and all those sort of things. But I just thought I would leave them as they pretty much originally were, but I've just packaged them up a little bit. Last but not least, a little plug. If you're in Sydney, January 19, I'll be doing the final night of my Willuminati tour. At the Sydney Opera House, we're taping that for a big special, so it's selling pretty well, but if you want to come and see that, that'd be cool. And my new show, Free Will, is on sale in Adelaide, March, and Melbourne already, so thanks to everyone who's already bought tickets to that. So that will be next year's tour, Free Will. So anyway, I'm not going to bang on too much. Please enjoy the original first episode of Willosophy with Todd Sampson. Cheers. Oh, and I also should give a big thanks to Nick at St. Hughes, who provided the intro music. He sent that to me, so please check out his music as the podcast go on. Over the next few weeks, I will give you more details and let you know how you can check him out if you enjoy that music. But I should give him a shout-out as well. Thanks, mate. Hello and welcome to Willosophy. It is my brand new podcast. We have a guest in our brand new podcast. We might as well introduce him and then I'll explain what the podcast is and then he can learn what it is at the same time, basically.
Sounds like a good idea.
And I can make it up at the same time. Look, here's the thing. I thought I could plan out this podcast really, really well. Oh, I should mention Todd Sampson is the other voice.
Oh, thank you.
Because I was about to then just start talking about the podcast. Hello, Todd Sampson.
Hello, everyone.
So this is called Willosophy and the idea was I wanted a podcast where I could talk to people that I find really interesting about what their philosophy was. Like, you know, was there something that they figured that they knew about life, or that was there a way, you know, a kind of a saying or a motto or a, you know, a philosophy by which they lived their life? And I thought if I talked to enough interesting people and we talked about why that was their philosophy, then people could listen to this in a row, and they could like hear interesting people say what they think the meaning of life is and what they think about life. And then I could start a religion. So basically, Todd, you're first off the rank. And before we get in,
like Scientology, like I need to hold something.
Right, I know it is. Like, yeah, I'm going to put you on an e-meter in just a minute. It's not Carl Sandilands. You're not going to be on a lie detector. It'll be fine. God. But you said something interesting to me. As a man that people will know probably from, firstly, I imagine if they're coming to this podcast, the TV show that we do together, the Gruen shows, but they also might know you from The Project. They might know you from your television show, Redesign My Brain, which we'll get to. And they might know you from the advertising world where, you know, you have been very successful for a very long time. But then on the way into us recording this podcast, you said something that blew my mind.
Uh-oh.
You said, I like your books, but I don't read books.
Yes, I don't read.
You don't read?
No. My parents never learned to read or write, so we never had any books at home. They never went to school. So my father learned to read when my youngest sister was born because he read the kids' books.
And is that right?
Yeah, yeah. No.
So they were learning to read at the same time almost?
My dad learned to read with my sister.
My God.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
That is amazing.
Yeah, like they don't even read the
newspaper. One night she would read the book. The next night he would read the book.
No, he looked beside his bed and he's got all these kids' books. You think if you were someone else and you walked in and saw that a grown man.
Oh, yeah, we need to get the authorities involved.
That's it.
Yeah,
exactly. Why is he reading that
and
stuff?
And why is he driving an ice cream truck slowly by schools? Well, let's start there then. So why – tell us about where you grew up and why your parents were in a situation where they wouldn't be able to read. Because that's interesting to people.
Yeah, I was born in Sydney, Nova Scotia, so northeast
Sydney to
Canada,
Sydney.
Sydney to Sydney.
Yeah.
And my dad worked in Coca-Cola, if you saw the show recently.
Yes.
It was on the show. Yeah, he worked in Coca-Cola for 27 years. My mom worked as a checkout girl at KFC.
Now, talk to us about what your dad did at Coca-Cola.
He poured sugar into vats. I could remember as a kid going in there and they'd all be smoking in the factory, you know, sitting in the back.
Ironically, then, probably healthier than drinking all the Coca-Cola.
And my dad used to have to get these huge bags of sugar, which he used to take home. And we used to have them, like when I needed to go get sugar, I would go downstairs out of these enormous bags and take a scoop.
So like that episode of The Simpsons where Homer finds all the sugar.
Oh no, I am The Simpsons. It's modeled on my life. Yeah, so
I love that.
So that was...
Did he know the secret recipe? Would you have been able to make your own Coke at home?
You know, I believed the whole fucking time that the secret recipe was in the bucket in front of KFC that turned around where my mother worked.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I used to always think, how am I going to climb that? How am I going to get up?
So he worked at Coke for 26 years.
Yeah, 26
and,
years.
And would you think that he would describe that as a positive like way to have lived his life?
Yeah, definitely.
Was he happy, you know?
Yeah, he was happy. He provided. You know, he earned $26,000 a year and he raised the kids. I didn't know any different. So in Canada, we would be just kind of at the poverty line, sounds so dramatic, but we'd be right there.
Right.
You know, he'd all the benefits and healthcare of that place. Mom earned whatever it was, a couple of dollars an hour at KFC. And that's how we were raised. The weird thing is I haven't had a drink of Coke for nearly 20 years.
When was the last time you had a KFC?
Even longer, since I haven't eaten meat in 22 years.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Was that because she worked at KFC? Was any of your decision about not eating meat?
No, when I ate it, I used to wait up at night for mom to come home. Right? I'd fall asleep on the sofa. I'd literally just lift my head up and she would stick the chicken in front of me and I would just chat that stuff down at like 3 a.m.
You're just at home with moist towelettes prepared.
Yeah, exactly.
Plastic knife and fork.
That's my life, Will. And then I wash it down with a Coke. But,
so how does a kid, so they get married, how old are they when they get married?
Yeah, well, mom had a child when she was 15
mm-hmm.
with another man.
Okay.
And as my mother says, he fucked me on a rock. mom's pretty full on. And then dad started dating her, right? And dad found out that she had a child.
Right.
And dad said, we'll take the child together mm-hmm. as a couple.
And how old is your dad at this stage?
72.
No, how old is he? Sorry, how old is he when this is happening?
Well, he would have been 18.
So he's 18 years old.
Yeah.
And he's offering to take on another child.
Yeah.
I mean, that's because I think I want to linger on that for just a second because, you know, I'm nearly 40 years old. And, you know, I think that I would have the capacity to do that, but the thought of it would terrify me. It's certainly not something I ever would have imagined at 18 years of age when I was packing up my car and going to university that, you know, That would be part of
the
my
crazier
life.
Thing was, imagine having a baby at 15. So mom fell pregnant, right? And at that young age. And then when she was giving birth, she said she could remember all the guilt. Like she had to go to a Catholic hospital because that's they had there. And she literally was kind of giving birth, showed up at the hospital, gave birth. And what did they do? They took the baby and they gave it to my aunt. Another long story, right?
So, right.
Because they said that she was too young to have a baby and her sister was older. They gave it to my aunt. She was raised my entire life as my cousin, but she was actually my half-sister.
Wow.
Yeah.
And when did you find out about that?
I found out. I used to record with a device a lot simpler than this. I used to record my parents' conversation, so I used to stick a recording device underneath their chair, then go to bed.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Are you serious?
Yeah. And my parents used to have some wild ones, you know, and then the next day, I would just listen to everything. And then one day...
I'm surprised you didn't become a spy.
One day, I was with my friend Herbie.
Yeah.
He's my best friend. And I said, let's play and see what they said last night. And I was listening to him. I was like, fuck, she's my sister. She's my half-sister.
Oh, God.
But I had known her the whole time.
If this wasn't a movie, no one would believe
no,
this.
No, exactly. And then only when her... So I confronted my mother years later on it, and she told me what had happened. And my sister went off to marry a Navy SEAL. And he spends his whole... So when the Iraq War was on, he was over there killing people in the dozens. That was his job. He was an elite killer, this guy. And he, amazingly, huge guy, really fit. But he left my half-sister, obviously, in America. She never knows where he's going. He just says, I have to leave for 3 weeks. So then I went over to see her. And I was 20... I can't remember how old I was. And that was the first time I saw her as my sister. That was just the most bizarre experience.
Wow. That's absolutely fascinating. Mm. So how do you get through school? Like if you have two parents who, you know, couldn't read at some stage, how are you encouraged to be a person who goes on and finishes school and, you know, graduates and goes to university and that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I could remember always, you know, walking home from school thinking, I don't want to live this life.
Right.
Like it's small town, Cape Breton Island, kind of, you know, not a lot of money, just it wasn't a nice existence. And I can remember thinking, I don't want to live that life.
My parents always used to say a very interesting thing about being a parent. And it was more about your kids living at home. But they always said, you've got to love them enough that they want to stay there until they finish school. And you've got to love them enough that they want to leave as soon as they finish school. You know, there is that great thing in sometimes where you're from somewhere. And I didn't want to be from the place I'm from either. I was like, well, I know that I don't want to be here. That's a start. Sometimes that's important.
You know, that's one of my – that is one
if it was
of my,
comfortable, you could stay. Hmm. And you might not do what you set out to do.
That's – one of my life lessons is based on that exact experience, which is – the path you carefully plan is the one you will never take.
Right.
And the notion that if you want, I could never have predicted to be here right now. I never would have imagined ever being on television. I never wanted to be a CEO. I never could have imagined that. Therefore, I could never have planned it.
Right.
So all these people have all these grandiose plans to get there. I doubt. Majority of people definitely do not follow the path they carefully plan.
Well, seeing that we've talked about philosophies, I did ask you to come with one. Mm. What would you say that it is if you have a philosophy?
That relates to that, I would say that doors open through effort, not through will. So because I've never imagined or planned to be where I am right now, therefore I couldn't have planned to get there. It's impossible. It doesn't make any sense. But what I did try to do throughout my life is everywhere that I went or whatever I did, if I was cleaning floors, if I was working in an advertising business, I tried to do that brilliantly, as best to my ability. And then the next door opened. But most people, especially this whole another generation, they just will the door to open. They just stare at the door. And I kind of come to believe as long as you do every little node, you know, in your life, whatever that is, to the best of your ability, another door will open. But if you stand there looking at it, there is no chance.
Okay. So that's not something that you just one day read in a magazine and decide is your philosophy, right? That's something that at a reasonably, I would assume, young age, you feel like you've at least adopted, even if you didn't know the words that you're saying then. When do you feel like you started to, you know, form that sort of mindset?
Probably in my mid-30s, maybe 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe 10 years ago, I kind of... what happened is, because I've had a fair amount of success in different areas of my life, people have always looked at me and gone, oh, you're so successful. They ask me how I got there. And every time I tried to explain it, I had no clear explanation. So
people don't want to hear No fucking idea.
That's it. Yeah, exactly. It's somewhat random. And they go, oh, well, that's not very inspiring.
Hey, Todd Sampson's put out a great advice book about how to be successful in business. It's
Don't
called,
try.
It's called Be Excellent. Other than that, I've got no fucking idea.
But I also believe you're where you come from hardens you or makes you who you are. Like I had a lot of crazy stuff in my childhood. And because I came from a relatively poor family, your starting point does define the end destination to some extent, I think.
Okay. So talk me through then. Where do you go to high school?
So I went to it's all pop. We didn't have any private schools. I didn't even know what they were until I moved to Australia. But there was no private school. So I went to a public school, normal school in the city. I went to the first one was called Kobe. And I went through that as a flunk out, basically. Bombed every subject. I was involved in a lot of, got involved very young in a lot of stuff I shouldn't have got involved in because there's nothing to do. So you turn to kind of petty crime and all right. that stuff at home. And then I went to high school. So I just kind of, and high, that's 7, 8, and 9. So by grade 7, I had one guy, I had one of my friends murder someone, and then I had one of my friends murdered by grade 7. So I was still a kid, you know, and so.
And why would people be murdering people in that part of the world?
Well, they differ, right? So the murdered one was a very close friend of mine who people drink and fight a lot where I'm right. from. And in fact, last time I went home, I was pulling one of my friends off another guy fighting on New Year's.
Why does that happen? Is it just boredom? Nothing else to do?
Not a lot to do there, and a lot of alcohol. Yep. Alcohol is part of the culture, so everyone's getting smashed and fighting. So the guy who got murdered, we were out with him at McDonald's, and that's not a plug. And we dropped him off at home, and he went into his house, and he opened the door, and his brother shot him dead with a shotgun. Now, what had happened is his brother had gotten in a fight in the city,
yeah.
and the guy that he got in a fight with said, "I'm going to come back and kill you." So he, is this too heavy? Will you take
no,
it?
I'm, no, I just, oh my God. Oh I mean, my I'm God. Glad that I've done this podcast. I feel like we've managed to make it 12 minutes in.
Yeah.
Like people will expect every,
all right, okay.
like every time I do this podcast, I'll be like, and so what age did you see someone?
You let me know, Will, if I'm sharing too
no,
much.
No, this is a back. Safe space, yes. Todd. This is the only it way is this is going to work.
It is quite a safe space.
Exactly. It's reassuring. It's a yeah. safe space. There's a blackboard here. Yeah. It's fine.
So anyway, his brother got in a fight and it was a bad fight. And the guy said, "I'm going to come back and kill you." So his brother thought, all right, he loaded up the gun and waited for him. Unfortunately, the person who walked in was his actual brother. So that's I was very close to him. That was a shock to all of us. We were all, you know, complete to lose we hung out in a little gang.
Right.
And that was one of them gone. So, and the guy who murdered, that's a weird story as well. Jesus, Will. where are we going to go with this? The guy who murdered was a very close friend. His name was Yopi, and he was a bit of a nutter the whole time. I mean, we all knew that. We didn't know how much of a nutter he was. Anyway, I was away at a summer camp thing, like a getaway camp, and he with a friend went hitchhiking. This is going to get weird, Will. Okay. His friend went hitchhiking, and they got picked up by an older couple. The couple took them to their destination and they went to get out. They said, "No, we're not getting out." They tied the couple up to opposite each other as a posts. They stabbed the woman to death and then went to stab the man, and he lived. So they took off with the vehicle. He lived, got out, crawled to a station. They eventually caught him and locked him up for life.
How, as a child who's, you know, 12... do you rationalize that? Like, how do your parents talk to you about it? How do you as a child, you know, deal with that?
Yeah, well, that I didn't really deal with it because I was in it, but my parents, they used it as a fire to say, "You do not want to live here."
Right.
You know, they were like, "This is not the life you want to live." And I can remember my mom distinctly telling me over years going, "This is not the life you need to live." And my dad used to hold his hands up and he'd have calluses all over his hands from working in the factory. And he'd say, "You don't want hands like this." So they gave me that fire to kind of get out. And then I went to high school, and a grade 7 teacher, science teacher, he made me do these kind of, I don't know what they were, if they were IQ tests or base tests or whatever they were. And I must have scored well. But I was in Canada, they segregate the schools. So if you're in 7-1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, they're like eating the glue and throwing staplers at the teacher. And 1 is all the mostly immigrants, smart kids,
yep,
that are doing really well. I was always in the four. Like I was okay. never in the five. I was
yeah,
the
you
four.
Weren't in the five.
I wasn't in the five. I was in the right. four. I wasn't eating the glue, but yeah. I was throwing things at other people. and then that's it. He went to the school, and the next year I came back for grade 8, and I was in a level 3. And then the next year I came back, and I was in a level 2. And I guess what happened is I just got really competitive. I just refused to believe that they would be so much better than me because they had money or because they were smarter mm-hmm. or whatever. So I literally just, a switch just flicked where I went, okay, I'm going to see if I can do this. And then I applied myself, really.
Were you competitive in everything that you did at that age? Like, was that a thing in your head that was in every aspect of your life, or was it just when it came to your education?
It came to education. I never did sport. I never wasn't involved.
Not at all?
No sport. I didn't have any.
Because you're a fit adult. Did you like run, or did you keep yourself fit, or were you just a kid?
That's a whole nother story, Will. That's, I mean, the fitness comes from a deeper place of kind of insecurity and issues that happened in my life again. And it's a whole nother, path, yeah. You know? I did all right at school. And then when I entered grade 11, so it goes to 12 in Canada, I had a history teacher. His name was Wild Bill, and he was wild. He was like, he had worked in Harvard and he had traveled. Like, he was the only person I knew that had actually seen the world. And his whole history class was about taking us to different places.
Right.
It completely blew my mind. Like, and so he...
Now, what did Wild Bill look like? Because I have a picture in my head, but I actually want to know what he looked like.
He was... actually, he kind of looked like a military guy. Like, he was a bit porty, and he had short hair, and he was rough. He was really... He taught two classes. I remember I asked him once. He taught the level one, so the elite students, and he taught five. And I remember once I asked him, I said, which one do you like teaching? Because he was so... I was in the one with him, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, Todd, I definitely like the five better. It was a very interesting guy. So he then said to me, Todd, I know this scholarship you should go for. If you get the scholarship, it'll change your life. And it's called United World College. It's a very, very one from this part of the world, Eastern Canada, will win. And so I didn't think anything of it. I didn't take the form. And then I was in Sea Cadets, and I went on this Navy destroyer for 3 months.
Yeah.
I was leaving that day, and my mother went to the teacher meeting. She'd never gone to teacher meetings before, really, nothing like that. And she showed up, and while Bill said, did he enter the scholarship? And she said, what scholarship? And he went upstairs, grabbed the scholarship, gave it to me. I went on this, my mother gave it to me and said, fill it out on the ship. I filled it out on the ship. They flew it by helicopter to Mexico, up to Canada, and I got selected in the top 10, and that changed my life forever. That completely changed my life. I then won a scholarship. I had to leave where I was from. I had enough money that I'd be able to study, you know, at where I wanted and what I wanted to do. And that was it. I never went back. I was 16, 17 years old.
I am amazed by how many people's lives are changed by school scholarships. Like, I think it's a thing that no one really thinks about. It feels like an old-fashioned system still, doesn't it? The idea of giving someone a scholarship.
I was the same.
I went to the local private school because my parents could afford it, but because I won a scholarship that paid for my education. And I otherwise wouldn't have been able to do that. And I certainly otherwise wouldn't have gone to a school where they had the appreciation of the arts and stuff that my high school did. It's kind of amazing. So, and also that idea of one teacher, because I find that, do you think you were encouraged at school? What do you think the qualities of a good teacher are?
He actually, it's like he noticed me. It's like he saw me, where the rest of the teachers, you were just whatever, you're one person in the audience. It was like he just took a special interest in me above everyone else for some reason. Now, maybe he was doing that to everyone else and I didn't know,
yeah.
But he was known to be the exceptional teacher in the school. He was known to be that, and as I said, he did both five and one. So he was an amazing, amazing guy. But you know, he just told stories of the world. And if you live in Sydney, Nova Scotia, Canada, in the backwaters of nowhere, you got these amazing teachers just explaining the world to you, it opens your eyes.
But also what you've said there is he explained the world to you. And sometimes I think that teachers forget, and look, you know, I'm no expert in this area, but I have a great deal of respect for teachers, but I think that the system we have isn't perfect either, and we need to find some way to make teachers be renowned and revered as you know, the people who explain the world to us all, you know, to have that respect in society. And then I think we'll get the right people, you know, to be in all those teaching positions again. But he explained the world to you. He wasn't teaching you history or wasn't teaching you geography. He explained the world to you. And that's the thing is, like, when you've got kids there, you know, if you're going to teach them maths, you've got to explain how maths is important in the world to them. Yes. So they go, oh, okay, I get this. This is why I will need to know this. Yeah, it's very interesting. So tell them before we get
But you know, on that, Will, when you said about teachers, I do think that in our lives, and you probably could name your five, we bump into these unique people, like these life-changing, like I call them nodes. You know, you bump into them and from that bump, you will go somewhere completely different again. And we probably get five, six, ten of them in our lives, you know, people that we just hit. And I often think, not to get, you know, goo-goo gaga about it, but I hope I get to be a node for someone else. Do you know what I mean? I hope someone meets me, I can do something for them, and they can go off and do something else.
So I had this feeling very recently, and it's something I've talked about on my other podcast, but, you know, this is a new podcast, and welcome new listeners. So I had a reaction the other day, a really unexplained reaction to something. Well, there is an explanation for it, but at the time, basically, there was some bad news, and I'll get to it in a minute, but I just kind of want to explain the feeling first and then tell you
the story. This is not the bad news show.
Yeah. someone that I didn't realize was as important to me, some bad news happened about them, and I was like really upset about it and had to examine why I was so upset. So the news was, and people would have seen this news, is that Billy Connolly has prostate cancer, and he had to have an operation for that. And at the same time, it was revealed that he also has the early stages of Parkinson's disease. And I was devastated. Now, that's not a person I know. It's a person I've met, but I don't know him. But I would not be doing what I'm doing today without him. Like that time when I sat in that audience when I was 17 years old and watched Billy Connolly with my mum and made the decision there in my mind of what I was going to do with my life. And I realized that I've had this glorious like life, you know, it's brilliant. It's like, you know, there's highs and lows and all those sort of things as everyone does. But essentially I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do for a living. And I'm doing that and I've been able to have this nice life and meet these nice friends. And, you know, if I can get money from a bank to build a house based on an idea that I had sitting watching Billy Connolly, right? And to hear that he was sick, to hear that he was unwell, that he was, you know, like suffering from something, it really affected me because I realized that so much of my happiness is because of that path that was started by that. Well, that's a node, isn't it?
That's a total node.
Like, I mean, Billy Connolly is a guy who I literally have only met once in my entire life, but he's like a node for me. Yeah.
But you know what, Will? I'd strongly recommend, based on my past Ed Hillary experience, go make it an effort to go see him and say thanks.
So, well,
like force yourself to do it because I had this with, I met Ed Hillary.
Yeah, let's talk about
he
this.
Was my, he was my Billy Connolly.
Yeah. Let's slow it down a little bit and explain that you have climbed Mount Everest.
Yeah.
And was this before you climbed or after?
Yeah. 2 weeks before I went to climb Mount Everest, I had just arrived in this country. I lived in South Africa. I lived in South Africa for 6 years. I came here.
And what inspired you to climb Everest?
Ed Hillary. Yeah. I'd watched and read and all the stories about mountaineers. And I've been climbing since I was a kid. Like I used to climb lots of rock faces across from my house. And I was really into it since I was really, really young. And, so 2 weeks before I go to climb Mount Everest, I arrive in Australia and I'm working for a very small, I know no one, I wasn't on the ABC, you know, I still didn't even watch the ABC. I wasn't on the ABC.
I'm not watching anything that doesn't have commercials.
That's it.
This is an insult to my industry.
Yeah, exactly. It's like free money. I was working for a very small advertising agency and my first gig was for the Australian Tourism Commission. And my first gig with those guys was to go to New Zealand. I flew to New Zealand. Off the plane, I got picked up by a chatty cab driver. He told me the story of his life. He told me about his son was a rock climber. He climbed all over New Zealand. We arrived at the Hilton Hotel and he said to me, "Do you know that Ed Hillary lives here?" And I was like, oh, of course, I knew he was a Kiwi. I didn't know he lived in Auckland.
But I guess he would. It's like the capital city. Exactly. Like if he was going to live somewhere, he probably does live in Auckland.
But, you know, in fairness to me, I didn't even know Auckland was a word before I had arrived in Australia. But
you're like, I assumed he lived on the top of a mountain somewhere, right?
So I went upstairs into the hotel and I thought, I wonder if he's in the White Pages. And I looked him up, and sure enough, in bold, in the white pages, is Sir Edmund Hillary. So I phoned him up.
That's also just a great compliment to New Zealand, though, isn't it?
Gotta love it.
That Sir Edmund Hillary can have his number in the white pages.
Totally. And so I phoned him up, and then he got on the phone, and he's a big, dark, rough voice. He spoke for maybe 30 seconds with me, and he said, Todd, if you'd like, I said, look, my name is Todd Sampson. I'm going to go climb Mount Everest alone. Yes. I was wondering if you could have, if you'd give me any words of advice. And he said, Todd, I'm going to be around here for the next 2 hours if you'd like to pop around for tea. So I fucking hung up the phone in complete shock, called up the Australian Tourism Commission and said, I'm going to be late. Ed Hillary's inviting me over.
I'm going over to Ed Hillary's place for scones.
I get in the cab and I tell the cab driver the address. Yeah. He goes, oh, you must have the wrong address. That's Sir Edmund Hillary's house. And I said, no, that's where I'm going. And he said, can I wait out in front?
Like, I also love that he knew where it was.
So I showed up and that's it. I went into his house and we spent an hour and a half together and then I went to Everest.
And now tell me, but I mean, without wanting to give away anything that you can't give away, just how does that hour and a half work? Do you sit down and have a cup of tea and a biscuit or something? Or do you, what happens there?
It is, I describe exactly what happened. So June took me in, his wife, and said, Ed's in the kitchen. I walked in and sure enough, lifelong hero, the person I looked up to my whole life, sitting there having tea. So I sat down with him. They poured some tea. And the best way to describe it is it was beautifully, beautifully ordinary.
Right.
So she said, would you like something to drink? I said, yes, please. She put some bickies down and we sat down and we talked and it was magical. Because at that time, I hadn't planned this, right? But right. I was so scared anyway to go climb Mount Everest.
Of course.
And to meet Ed Hillary 2 weeks before, I felt like a light had opened and it's going to be like, you're okay.
Yeah.
That's how I felt from that. So we spend an hour and a half together. But the reason I tell you that story, Will, is because I didn't loop back. So when I came down from Everest, I should have looped back and at least shown him a photo with me and signed it and said, thanks, Ed. And I didn't. And he died.
Right.
So this is my Billy Connolly thing. If you feel like that about him and he has made a difference to your life, make the effort, man. Just go find him and just say thanks. He may not, it's nothing to do with how he reacts.
Right.
But you're Will Anderson. You'll be able to get to Billy Connolly. Get to Billy Connolly.
Well, see, you've inspired me on that because my thoughts weren't that big, but I was actually just like, do you think it would be inappropriate if I wrote him a letter? Like I was thinking that I could write him a letter and just explain to him, you know, who I was and not that I need him to care, but just... Because the thing that I wanted him to know was not just that I was a fan and it had made, you know, that his comedy had made my life better, but hopefully, like if you work on the idea that the idea of the comedian is they go out on stage with the aim of bringing happiness to people, that like hopefully over the years some people have got happiness out of my work as well that was created by him. So he kind of is partly responsible for all that happiness as well. You know, even of things that he wasn't involved in. And I think I would like to know that. If someone, you know, but I don't know. Like,
Will,
it's embarrassing.
Go kinda. See him. Get your people to sort it out.
I do have people.
And go see him.
I must admit, I do have people. Get I should those use people. Them occasionally.
Those people, the 25 or 30% you pay them, whatever you pay them. That's to do that. You regret it, Will. I know I did. I then sent a photo to his wife after he died, signed to Ed, and they ran it in the paper and they ran a story in the Sydney Morning Herald. So I felt good that they at least acknowledged him, you know, everywhere as they should.
Yeah, it's amazing. So let's talk about Everest then if we can. Mm. So when did you decide you were going to do it? How long then is the process to, you know, get ready to do it? And what is that process? I don't even know. Because we've talked on my other podcast, TOEFOP, quite a lot. We had one episode where we went through facts about Mount Everest. It was the anniversary of Sir Edmund Hillary. And just the people who die and the danger, the real danger in that journey. Like, what was it about it and how did you go about it?
I think that Everest was one of the last mountains that I did, right? So I've been climbing my whole life. But I think I always climbed chasing that kind of approval from whom I don't know, but you know, it's a way of filling the hole type thing, you know? Sure. So I've done it my whole life and I've wanted to climb Everest since I could probably about 13, like I read about it and thought, I want to do that. And I want to see if I could do that and all that came with it. And so I think I spent 20, maybe 25 years training for it. Like people say, oh, did you do 6 months of, you know, I did like right. 25 years of,
yeah.
of training. And in the end, I wasn't going to do it. Like right. I kind of gave up.
But are you saying that if I started now
you should be right.
at age 64 or so, I could really nail it?
Why don't you hold out a bit longer and you'll set some world records? Yeah.
Yeah.
Just wait 20 more years.
I started training at 70 when I got my fourth set of fake hips, but I've really nailed it at 95.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, so that's so I don't. It was,
so what then happens though? Is it so then you decide? Okay, I'm going to climb yeah. Mount Everest,
and then you decide how. So yes. you decide whether you pay to go in a group. So you mm-hmm. could pay, I think now it's 60,000 US or 70,000 US, something like that. And mm-hmm. you join a group of people, 9 people that go for the summit of the mountain. Or you can decide to do it the way I did it, which was I wasn't going to go with anyone. I was going to go, well, not the people all over the mountain, but I'm going to pay to get on a ticket. Mm-hmm. So there's a ticket and there's 10 names on a ticket and it's $10,000 each to climb Everest. That goes straight to the Nepalese government. And so I paid to get on a ticket. I never met any of those people. I didn't know who they were, but I had some base camp support and with a guy called Tim Ripple, who was an amazing climber. And that's it. So then it took me 3 months to do it, roughly 3 months to do it from the top, from Sydney to the top, back down to Sydney.
Hmm.
Yeah. And it was hard and cold, but it was amazing. Like it is like living, that 3 months is like an entire lifetime. Like it's like living out an entire lifetime. The ups and downs are all so exaggerated because of the danger and all the shit you go through in your mind. It's like speeding up your life and stacking it into 3 months and saying good luck with that and see how you go.
When you've climbed Mount Everest, do you keep climbing? Or, yeah. Or are you like, I'm done, I climbed Mount Everest?
No, well, unfortunately then a year later or 2 years later I had children, you know. Unfortunately for that.
If we just take that quote out of context, yes. That'll sound horrible.
You know what I mean. And then I just promised my wife that I wouldn't go above like 6,000 meters yeah. so that until the kids are older, you know, and now I'm teaching them to climb. But yeah, climbing is the ultimate in, you know, people talk about moving meditation. It's the ultimate in that because you forget everything. You forget you got a family. You forget you've got bills. You forget your job. Everything goes away. Relationships all gone. The only thing you think about for 3 months is, am I cold? How's the weather? Am I physically okay? Am I feeling sick or not? And what should I do today? That's it. There's no room for, oh, how's life? It's just too intense. You're too in it.
That sounds terrible.
And you've got to like cold.
You can take weed, right?
Yeah, you can.
That's fine. I can.
You can. Yes.
What do you got in your pack? Look.
That's why the Sherpas drink. Yeah. That's exactly it.
All right. And do you have Everests in other aspects of your life, do you think? Like, you know, is there an Everest in advertising? Is there an Everest in television? Like, you know, do you feel like that's, you know, you have these sort of, you know, things that you see as being, because, you know, you said you're not a person who plans your career, but in each thing, do you go, oh, that would be like the Everest of that? Or
not really. Like, no. I don't really. I guess from a physical mountaineering perspective, Everest is the symbol of, it's the highest mountain in the world. Yeah. So it is the kind of, it is the top, although not nearly the hardest, you know, it's just the tallest. But no, I kind of wish I felt like that in my career. I wish that I could just tie a bow on it and go, look, I've done it. But it just seems to be ever changing.
So. Do you think that there will, so tell us how you found advertising.
I was studying, I eventually went on to do an MBA in South Africa. That's how I got there. Yep. And the only reason I chose that is I had another scholarship and the criteria was I couldn't study in North America, which was perfect for me. Mm-hmm. And Nelson Mandela had just been released and I kind of admired him, but didn't know him. And I literally said, is there something down in South Africa? And there was. It was an amazing school in Cape Town. And so I chose to spend the money in Cape Town. I went there and I did an MBA. And in the second year, halfway through, the marketing lecturer, she broke her back. And she ended up in Traction. And she got guest lecturers to come in. And one of the guest lecturers was a creative director. He spoke for 45 minutes about creativity, imagination, and linked it to business. And I went, that's it.
And did you know then, like, did you go, okay, this is something that I could do as a career?
Yes. And you know the funny thing?
It was a light bulb moment?
Here was the light bulb moment, that I could make the link between creativity and business.
Right.
That was a light bulb moment where I went, oh, because from what I knew of business, and I worked for a bit as kind of an investment banker, and it was all in the cubicle. I didn't think there was anything else. I thought that was corporate life.
Yeah.
And then someone said, no, 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 you could have this. So your whole, every day can be about thinking of good or bad, but thinking of new things and imagining solutions to problems and laterally thinking. I went, fuck, all right, let's do that.
And still have money.
And still have money. Yeah.
We've combined those two things.
That's it.
There's a sweet spot on the Venn diagram where you don't have to be boring to have money.
Totally.
But there's not that many jobs.
But there's a cost to it, you know, in working in an industry that's a demand generation business. But so anyway, I went down to meet him. So I was completely blown
away. I like that term, by the way, demand generation business.
Yeah.
That's how I'm going to describe comedy now. Like instead of, oh, people just want new shit all the time.
Smile generation business.
Right. Everyone's, but everyone's like, oh, people just want new shit all the time. I'm sorry. No, it's a demand generation business. That's what it is. That's what it is.
Of all people, you know what I mean.
What happens then?
I went down to see him. And you know what he said to me? He looked at me in this dismissive kind of down his nose at me and said, good luck with that.
How much do you remember that moment?
I clearly remember that moment. I remember that guy. I remember thinking, fuck you.
Is that guy a node? Like in a different way?
Well, I've never really thought about that actually.
Because I have a theory that sometimes there is those, like there's a few people in my fuck you file that I think have had probably more influence over my drive and my career than the people who positively encouraged me. The ones who told me that I couldn't do it still stick in my mind. I still know that moment they told me that I couldn't do it. And I'm like, oh my God, that was 30 years ago. You're fine. Like, why are you still hanging on to the fact that if you saw, you know, Esther Cribbies from fucking high school, that you would go, fuck you. See, I fuck you. But at the same time, I think, well, maybe I wouldn't have done all this stuff if I hadn't like had a bit of, I want to prove you wrong as well.
You know what? I never thought of this. I've not hate, but a mild form of hate for this bloke, but maybe you're right. You know, maybe, because I remember thinking, I remember standing and it was down in front of the MBA class. Like the class was in kind of an oval shape and I went down to see him. He had long hair and disheveled, you know, disorganized guy. And when he looked at me and said, you know, good luck with that. I do remember thinking,
that's a closed door.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, because he was big in the industry as well in South Africa. He's one of the top. If I said his name and anyone knows the industry, they would know him.
You've gone to the door, you know, to use your, you know, saying, you've gone to that door and he's just slammed it shut in your face. Mm. Now, you have a choice then at that point to go, all right, then, you know, I'll go off and do something else. And I was very close. Be put off.
Strange thing is I was at the third round interview with McKinsey's. I was going to be a management consultant.
Uh-huh.
Thank fuck, that fell through. But, I mean, but you know, that would have been a stressful life. But I mean, when you say it like that, it's true. He closed the door and I had another one open, but I still chose to go through that door.
Yeah. That's, I mean, if making those choices yourself are very important. Sometimes I think when someone says no to you, You genuinely are going, oh, well, despite that, I'm going to do this. And you own your choice.
Mm.
And once you own your choice, you're not just floating around with, you know, where you've been going. I think that can be really powerful. So what happens now after this?
Then I entered the advertising business quite senior because I had an MBA. So people immediately thought, you know what you're doing.
Right.
And I had no idea what I was doing. And I entered a company called the White House and it was an amazing time. I learned on the job very fast. I never got in as a junior. I was stuck as a senior person straight from the beginning. And I learned a lot. I loved it. I mean, it was amazing time.
How do you, if you're going in as a senior into an industry where you don't have experience, did you deal with jealousy and resentment and stuff like that?
Yeah, a bit of that.
And did you have to learn? Were you a person who was good with dealing with people, or did you have to learn how to deal with people?
I was always okay with dealing with people, but there was a lot of jealousy. There was just because at the time in South Africa, the MBA really meant something. You know, having those really helped with opening doors for business. Nowadays, you know, it's a dime a dozen really with MBAs. Everyone's done them. Anyone who's confused in corporate life or doesn't know what to do academically, they do MBAs.
Right.
Because it's just like the neutral zone. You know?
That's all right. Anyone who really wants to be an artist when they grow up but are still putting off their appearance and hoping that they're going to have an education, do BAs. So it's fine.
Fair enough. Anyway.
You went there and did you love it? Do you feel like at the start you're like, okay, I love this? How were you, like, nervous about the way your job was going? Did you find the job hard at the start? How did you deal with those things?
I started as a writer because I didn't know what to do, right? Mm-hmm. But I ended up doing a lot of strategy work because of the MBA title. So the guy running the business would take me into business meetings, because the one thing that an MBA does really well is it provides you with a language that you can use at all levels of an organization. So I could speak that language. So I went to those meetings. So I quickly realized that I would be better in the bridge between creative and account management. And that's strategy. And so that's how I fell into that, because I'm a creative person, but I'm more of a strategist, you know, the mix of those two things. So, and that was my calling card throughout my life in the industry, that what I tried to combine was creativity and strategy, where everyone else was one or the other.
Now, is there any irony in the fact that someone who's come in here with the self-professed motto that they don't really plan ahead is an expert in strategy? Or is that... is that why you're good at strategy? For the guy who at the start of this podcast said, I don't really plan anything.
That is why I can plan it for other people. talking about life's journey, not how to make $2 million in the next 2 years.
Right.
Yeah.
But they're both strategy,
yeah,
right?
They're both strategies. There is something ironic that I'm not one for my own life strategy, or believe that they really work, other than getting into the next door. That was my job, strategy. And strategy is such a cool position in an agency. So if you imagine, I'll go with it anyway, a fishing analogy, which is often used. So the strategist's job is to get the boat over the fish, and the creative's job is to throw the fish, the line in, and catch the fish.
Right.
And so a strategist is like a navigation system for a plane. And so it's such a brilliant position in an agency.
Okay. So how do you start rising through the ranks? When do you first get a promotion?
I get them when I'm there. So by the time I was ready to leave South Africa, I was at what they call strategy director level. So I was at like number four in the company by the time I left South Africa. And then in this, the advertising business, it's all about leapfrogging. Every place you leave, you need to end up in a better spot. Right, that's basically how it works.
Right.
Most people don't leave to end up in a worse spot. So
right.
And so
there's a lot of agencies just going, you only work at this agency twice. Once on the way up, once on the way back down.
That's it. That's it.
So there's a lot of comedy rooms like that too.
I'm sure there
are. Yeah. Okay, so every time you get a new job, you're trying to go into a better position or a better, you know, place to be doing the job.
Yeah, right? So I'm climbing a lot now. So I'm living in Cape Town. I'm climbing a lot.
What's living in Cape Town like?
Oh, it's just unbelievable.
So what era is this? Tell me what the years were.
It would be amazing.
Right. That was the slogan that lost Todd the South African tourism
they know
campaign.
What I mean.
We're in Vaucluse. All the South Africans are here.
Yeah, that's it.
They knew.
They're all out. It was an amazing, amazing place. Like, I was living at a time when it was in this big cultural transition. So Mandela's just released, black government is in power. It never had black government. They weren't even allowed on, you know, the buses together.
Right.
So now you've got this whole transition where you've got a population of whatever it was, 88% of them are black, 12% white, the rest are kind of ethnic, smaller ethnic groups. Now, forever, the white has controlled all of it, and the Afrikaners. Now it's a complete switch. So living through that was an amazing time. Like, it was, even when I finished the MBA, there were two black people on the MBA, Sandile, who became a really good friend of mine. When we finished the MBA on the graduation, we went down on the waterfront of Cape Town. We go into a bar. Everyone's piling through. It's our last night. We're all having a good time together. And they stopped Sandile at the door. And they wouldn't let him in because he's black. I mean, that's amazing. I was completely shocked. I was like, and the guy was huge.
I mean, it's amazing. This is in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Like,
this is only 17 years ago. And he's standing there beside me, and we're getting in an argument with this guy, and he's just looking at us like, I don't even know what it's like. We were speaking a completely different language to him. And so we ended up yanking the rest of the guys out, and we went somewhere else. And then Sandile went on, I heard recently, to become some kind of massive oil tycoon, because a black man with an MBA is like, they didn't have to go to recruitment. They were like,
oh, yeah, right. Hey,
there's two of them on the course. Hey,
front of the line. It's front of the line now.
And unfortunately, Sandile knew it.
At that time, there was as many black people with MBAs as there were white people in the NBA. Well done, Will. Thank you. Thank you very much.
True.
Okay, so What gets you out of South Africa then?
I was climbing a lot and traveling a lot. And then I read in the newspaper in the Cape Times that 9 people were killed with a hatchet about 20 minutes from my house. And that kind of was a switch for me. I went, okay, I can't live here forever. I love it. I never wanted to leave, but I will never be able to have a family here. And it's not sustainable for life, but it was unbelievably brilliant. And that was it.
It's amazing, though, that again, at this point in your life, you have made a decision about where you're going to go because of the place that you're at being inappropriate to be anymore.
Mm.
Like the decision, like, you know, the same way you left your childhood home, not because necessarily.
Well, you're freaking me out because I am not putting these things together on my own.
Right.
I feel like
this is going to be the perfect podcast for me. I love nothing more than having these conversations.
Okay.
But, you know, you went away from your childhood home because you're like, this is not the place for you. You need to be somewhere better. It wasn't like you have to go there.
Mm.
It was like, you can't be here.
That's right.
Like, that's even what your parents said. You can't be here. Not you need to go there, right? And again, when you're in South Africa, your decision isn't, I want to go here. It's, I can't be here, right? Which is really interesting, even to go back to, you know, that idea of you not saying in your own life, I want to go here. You're saying, I can't be here anymore. So I want to go somewhere.
And now
that's
when you say it like that, I do get the short term thinking then, right? Because I don't know what the next destination is. I know I just have to deal with the one I'm in.
Yeah.
And if I deal with that one well, something else will open up.
Right.
And so then it was time for me to leave. And I wanted to continue climbing and all of that stuff. But I'd learned to live in the South. And once you learn to live in the South, having grown up in the North, you can't go back.
Right.
And so I looked around. I thought, where can I live in the world? South America. I don't really speak Spanish. It would be tough. Different parts of Asia wasn't really interested in going to. And this funny country that I knew very little about, but romanticized about, Australia. And I packed up one day and I contacted a headhunter in Sydney.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, I gave him my CV and what I was doing. And I said, could you contact the top 10 agencies in Australia? And I'd like to come and do a kind of tour type thing and meet them. Well, I was, at the time, the number one agency in Australia was a private agency, Australian company called the Campaign Palace. Russell has subsequently closed that. He won't like me saying that, but lots of stories. God love you, Russell. I'll never forgive you for that. So I then interview at 10 agencies, got rejected by all of them. And I was it was a Friday afternoon, and the only agency of the 10 that was on the list that wouldn't see me is the Campaign Palace, the one I wanted to see.
Of course.
Best in the country, one of the best in the world. And so I went there. I thought, fuck it. The headhunter said they don't want to see you. They have someone in the job.
Right.
So I went there. I showed up in the reception. And the receptionist went and contacted the guy who was running it, Reg. And Reg said, look, if he wants to wait for 45 minutes, I'll wait. I'll see him. We're in a meeting right now. So they put me in a room, a small room about the size of this, with a TV, because at that time only television ads were made.
Right.
And their television ads, all the AFL ads, all the old stuff. They did all the first Leap stuff that was ever done. It was fucking mind-blowing. I was sitting there going, holy shit, this is the best I've ever seen. I waited, 45 minutes went, 1 hour, 1 hour and a half, 2 hours, and I think, I'm not going to sit here and wait.
What are you doing even in that time?
I'm sitting thinking. I'm stewing, actually.
Do you have a newspaper, a magazine?
I watched the commercials twice. That's what I did. I watched their reel twice. And then I went to my hotel, and I left my details at the reception. I went to my hotel, and I was leaving the next day on Saturday, and I got a phone call saying, would you like to come back? They're sorry about that. They're having a barbecue on the deck. They used to have barbecues every Friday night. I go there, a bit pissed off. I speak to the guy, Reg Bryson. We speak for maybe 45 minutes together. And he looks at me and he says, how much money do you want to earn? And I went, what? And he said, how much money do you want to earn? I said, which was clearly too low. Excellent strategy. I've used it. I've used it so many times throughout my career, because then you can't complain about how much money you earn, because you just told me how much you earn. And then I came back and I worked at the best agency in the country. That's how I got to Australia. So again, I leaped onto a very solid platform, to leap off, to get on in the palace, and then to leap off of that is a very good platform for upwards.
But again, it was one of those times where someone closed the door and you went and, no, I'm not going to put up with that. So you start working in advertising in Australia,
yeah.
I mean. And let's skip forward a bit to when we meet doing our television shows. This is like 6 years ago now, right?
Yeah.
How does Where are you at your career at that point? And what happens when someone rings you to say, hey, we can do a TV show?
Yeah, well, I'd just become CEO. So literally, I just started in the job as running. So I was the head of strategy. So I was number two for a number of years.
Yep.
And then I would just took over the top job. And then I had a message in my office from Andrew Denton. And when you get a message from Andrew Denton, and I'd lived in Australia for a while, so clearly I knew who he was, you take the meeting. And I took the meeting, and he explained it to me. I'll never forget that we joke about our two different versions of this story, right? Because he remembers it slightly differently than me, but this is what I remember. I remember that he came in my room with some other people talking. They talked about it. They explained the idea to me, and I shook my head, and I said, I can't do that. I can't do an idea that's going to take the piss out of the industry. I'm running one of the largest companies in the country. It'd be crazy to do that. And he said to me, okay, well, are you willing to do a workshop? And I'm like, workshops, that's our bread and butter. I'll do a workshop, no problem.
Right.
So he says, okay, can you do it on Saturday at 10:30? And so I show up on Saturday at 10:30, and I knew something was weird. It felt a bit funny. There were people mulling around, and someone said, Will Anderson's in there. And I was like, holy shit, because I was a Will Anderson fan beforehand. And literally, they brought me in the room, and I was completely fucking shocked when I saw you sitting in the center of this table, 20 or so people in the audience, three of those big cameras there, and people I didn't know on the panel. And we literally said, okay, we're going to do the workshop now. And I was like, what workshop? When do we sit around with notepads around a table? Because that's the workshop I came for. And then we did the show.
So it was a definitional issue.
It was a definitional issue. And then we did the show, and that was it. I enjoyed doing it. And then Andrew had a conversation with me where he said, Todd, I promise you, this is not a quiet send up of the industry.
Well, so let's linger on this moment for a while. So suddenly there's a point where, you know, he's saying, like, you know, and I don't know how exactly this happens, but I know that having been behind the scenes on that, you know, we had a very short list of the people that we thought were capable of doing the show in general, which was our list of people who, you know, would be hopefully on the show in the first series. But also we were looking at having two regulars, and there was only three people who were, in our opinion, possibilities for those jobs. But I'm guessing that much wasn't being explained to the other people.
I didn't know that.
No. So how is that conversation? Because you're talking to Andrew Denton, who we might stop down before we get to this, and I will mention, because I imagine this will come up over the course of these podcasts. Andrew Denton is one of my notes.
And mine as well.
So people have probably heard me tell this story, but if you're new to the podcast, I apologize. I'm probably going to tell stories over and over. That's what this is going to be about. But when I was 14 years old in the country watching television, we used to have two TV networks. People these days, you know, where everyone can't even watch TV without getting it on fucking Twitter or watching on split screens. We didn't have two screens. We had two fucking TV networks. There was the ABC, and there was a composite commercial channel that just played bits and pieces of, you know, other commercial network shows and then local ads and local news. So
ratings would have been easy back then, wouldn't it?
Oh,
it's one or the other.
They dominated. You're either an ABC person or not ABC person. And so when I was at that right age, you know, that if you believe in that sort of Malcolm Gladwell, you know, idea of like the right place at the right time. And it was one of those things where there was two television shows. One was called The Big Gig. And one was called Andrew Denton's The Money or the Gun. And The Big Gig was a TV comedy program that had some of the funniest people on television on it. But it had Doug Anthony All-Stars, who I fell in love with. And it was the first time I saw people like, you know, Jim Owen and Wendy Harmer and Greg Fleet and all these people do stand up. And it was inspirational to me. I thought that was the funniest and most irreverent people I had ever heard in my life. You know, I was like, people can say this and people are fine with it and they actually enjoy it. This is brilliant, right? And the other one was Andrew's show, which it was as funny but more serious. Like The Money or the Gun, for people who are listening who don't know that show, if there's any way of finding old copies of that show, I've watched some of them. And some of them are a bit daggy, you know, because it was 30 years ago. But some of them still hold up today. They did one that won a bunch of awards called The Year of the Patronizing Bastard. And if they put that on TV today, it'd still be confronting to people. And it's still wonderful television. And he used to have this running joke where every week he'd get a different band to do a version of Stairway to Heaven. He always had that great thing of, I'm doing something serious here. Like, I can do a whole show about disability. But you know, at the end, people are also tuning in for you know, the Doug Anthony All-Stars doing Stairway to Heaven.
Mm.
And he's taken that through all his shows, you know. That's one of the things when we were putting together Gruen was that idea that it can't just be about learning or people will not enjoy this. Mm. You've got to remember, you know, the band doing Stairway to Heaven at the end, you know. Some people are tuning in for that. So when I was 14, I was obsessed with those two shows. And so I knew the names Ted Robinson and the name Andrew Denton, you know, off by heart. And then I was excited later in my career when I got to work with those people. But the most hilarious thing is that I am 39 years old and I have only ever done two major television projects, The Glass House and The Gruen Shows. And the first one was produced by Ted Robinson and the second one was produced by
Amazing.
Like 14 years old when
that's amazing.
They first started influencing my life. And then at various times that both of those men have influenced my life since then. I find that amazing. Like it blows my mind a little bit.
And I wonder if those people are all around us, but we just don't bump, like we don't bump into them. Do you know what I mean? Like we don't connect in, at some level or we don't see them because they don't, I don't think they just randomly show up. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think they're probably all around us.
Okay. So talk to me about your experience with Andrew Denton.
So he, my experience with Andrew was, I also admired Andrew and I loved his humor and his quickness and all of that. And so his weight, I do remember another thing, him, the other reason convincing me to go to another workshop, right? So I was like, oh, I don't want to do another one after I did that one with you. And then I'm like, I'm not certain about this whole thing. Like I was happy, but I was like, I don't want to go through this again. I don't want the stress of it.
Right.
And then he said to me, he goes, Todd, we need you to go there because we don't know if people sweat under the lights.
Yeah.
And I went, what do you mean? He goes, Todd, sometimes we just put the lights on people and really rolling for real and people just start sweating profusely. Now, are you shaking your head like that's true?
Yeah.
Because I thought, I started laughing thinking, that is an excellent con job.
No.
It's see a, if it's, I sweat.
No, well, I mean, he means it in two ways. And you've seen this over the history of doing our show.
Mm.
There are people that are who are experts in the industry, who are wonderful at their jobs, who can't do our show, you know? And it's just because, and there are people who aren't industry heavyweights who do fantastic jobs on the show because it's about, you know, making a TV panel show work, which is a mystical art that no one really understands. But we just do our best each week to understand it better and try to make it work. But some people literally sweat under the lights. You know, people, they the sweat comes through and some people just, their tongue gets big and they can't do because suddenly they're in front of an audience and they see a TV camera and they realize that millions of people are going to see what they're saying and it gets inside their head.
God love him. He's one of our favorites and we both adore him. But I remember in season one doing it and sitting there at the panel and my, I was sitting there thinking, I'm feeling really uncomfortable. My balls are frozen. Like I'm thinking, why am I so cold in my groin?
Right.
I then looked down and Dan had a fan below his legs, but he had kicked it and shot it straight up between mine. So the whole time it was just blowing this cold air on my balls while I was doing the show.
He was a great example of someone who literally sweats under the lights.
Yeah.
It's horrible. It always makes you look like you're on a lie detector. Like if people are sweating, people are like, I don't trust him anymore. Why is he sweating? Because I'm in a suit and there's hot lights on.
Yes.
There's actually really decent reasons to be sweating. But somehow at home you all think I'm dodgy now.
So Andrew basically just gave me the trust me story. He said, Todd, you have to trust me. This is not about, you know, this is not about us having some underhanded, you know, mission against the advertising industry. You guys will be free to say, it'll be unrehearsed. You'll be free to say and do whatever you'd like to do. And he said, you're going to be opposite a guy called Russell Howcroft. And I said, who's that? And he said, oh, he runs another agency. And I went, oh, okay, well, that'll be interesting. And then the next workshop, Russell and I met with you.
And then
it all went down.
Like, but in that moment, and no one could have ever predicted it, but no one could have predicted the idea that 6 years later, your and his names would be so, like, you're like fucking Lennon and McCartney, you know? Like, there will never be a point in your life where you won't be at least in some way associated with each other.
Yeah, and we, the three of us have been, not to keep with the analogy, but the three of us have kind of become nodes for each other. Like, we in some ways have laid down a show, hopefully that people will remember, you know? And people talk to me about, you know, is it all genuine with you and Russell? It's absolutely genuine. But we're not good enough to act. So we're just being who we are, and we have differing opinions on things, but we share similar values in a lot of ways, and it's all genuine. Like he does, we don't plan this. We don't sit in the back room and think. It just comes out, and it's not that I'm right or he's wrong or the other way around. It's just two different people.
But television is a very different industry, and I want to talk a little bit about this because, of course, people see just the television show, which is what they're meant to see, by the way. Like, I'm not judging people for this, but I have people ask all the time about whether you guys get along. And I'm like, you know, they share a dressing room, like yeah. They juggle together, yeah. They're friends. They have a lot of human values that are identical. They just have a couple of things when it comes to the world of advertising and they disagree on. But also, we're making a television show. We have 35 minutes. If two people say the same thing, we tend to cut one of them out.
Yeah, that's
because there's no fucking point repeating it.
Yeah,
but if two people say opposite things, it almost always makes the cut because we want to hear people to hear, you know, opinions. So disproportionately, it does seem like you disagree more than you probably actually disagree.
Although when he did one day say to me, we both went to tennis with our clients, and he said, do you want to come to my house afterwards in Melbourne? I said, yeah, sure. Russ would be great. And he said, but beforehand, let me take you to the school I went to. I nearly died inside at the wealth of school, Scotch College. He took me down to a field, right? One of the fields in the middle. And he said to me, unless you are at the top, you're not even allowed to touch this field. And then we were walking back and I said to him, I said, what the fuck's that building? It looked like some heritage building. And he said, that's their hospital.
They have a hospital?
I thought, wow. That is something else.
Right.
Good old, I love Russell. He is a dear friend, and I've grown up with him on television.
Like right.
Our relationship has evolved in front of an audience.
But now I want to talk about this idea of suddenly you're a person. So you're someone who is well known within your own industry. You're the boss of your company now. Like, you know, so I imagine within the industry, people are really familiar with you now.
Not hugely well known. No, I mean, yeah, they would be familiar with me. They would have known that I took over running that company.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but that's not like being on TV, is it?
No, that's completely different.
So, and because here's the most. Because
they went from knowing me in the industry to like hating me immediately.
Well, I imagine that some people would have, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Because I certainly think originally there must have been a fair bit of the industry. And look, I know personally there still is some of the industry who don't like the show.
Yeah.
And so it's a big choice for you to say, I've just become the boss of this thing. I'm going to go on this show that I know, even if Andrew Denton is right,
yes,
like even if I can trust him, there are still going to be people in my industry who suddenly just got pissed off at me, either because they genuinely think it is bad for the industry, or B, they're just jealous that it's not them or whatever. That's a big choice to make.
Yeah, and also just very quickly after the first couple of two apps, I realized that, sure, it was our choice to say what we wanted to say, but it was a bit like enough rope for advertising people. You could go as far or as little as you wanted to go. And most people under the pressure of performance will go pretty far,
yeah.
You know? And I know there are many times in the show where I've said things and I've gone, wow, that, I think I've just gone too far there. And I just came out. It's too late. It's already out there, you know? And so, yeah, I did. I had that. And I just resigned myself to a very simple philosophy. I said, I'm going to say exactly what I would say in a boardroom. I'm going to say on television. I'm going to be absolutely no different. I'm going to be this. I want people that know me in the industry or know me from my company to go, he's exactly like that. He would say that about my brand. He'd say that about my advertising. And that was my philosophy the whole show. Even when I got, and I have been in very sticky situations where I've had a go at some of my own clients' work on national television. And I've had a go at some of my own work on national television. I've just stuck to the principle of would I have done that if the cameras weren't on?
So your life starts to change a bit because you're on the telly. How do you notice that changing?
First year was just a massive adrenaline ego rush. You know, it's like, wow, okay, people are recognizing you. We're on a hit show. The show in the first year was enormously successful. I mean, do you remember what it was like? Everyone was talking about it. It was doing millions of people every week, and it was a surprise hit and all of that. And so it was just getting noticed and feeling I couldn't watch the show. for the first kind of year.
Interesting. So you didn't watch it at all?
I couldn't watch it. No, I couldn't.
Did you try to?
I tried. Yeah.
Because I find it uncomfortable to watch myself. And then this year, because I'm co-EPing the show, because I'm in the edit a bit more and a bit more responsible for some things. First few episodes this season, I sat down and watched them and gave some notes the next day and all those sort of things. And then I got about halfway through the season and went, look, it's going fine. I don't need to look at it anymore. Because it is hard to watch yourself back. But at the same time, I imagine that in your line of work, you've got to also sometimes do things that are uncomfortable to improve. People have to – you can't just think – so I imagine that you, as a person who wants to do things well, were you taking advice or were you getting other people to watch it and give you advice, or were you just – like how were you, dealing with that?
I had to – no. Advice to be in the television – look, I never thought it would last.
I thought we'd do a year together. I mean, that's sensible. You're absolutely right about that. Nobody thought it would
last. So I wasn't like laying down the foundation for a long career. I was like, okay, well, this will be fun. I get to hang out with Will Anderson and we get to muck around on TV and all of that. And then after the first year, the second year came and it was another hit.
Yep.
I thought, okay, well, this is becoming more permanent now.
Right.
and my life is permanently starting to change.
Yep. So at that point, did you have a moment where you have to make a decision about whether you're comfortable with that being a thing?
I sat down and talked to Naomi, my wife, about it, and I said, this now it's going down the point of no return, right? So now I think it started for me, it started
because she hasn't signed up to that.
No.
So let's pause down here for a second and talk. And again, I'll just ask questions and in the enough rope way, but please only give me things you're comfortable with because I don't want to pry around. It's not about that. But I'd like to talk to you about love and did you find love in Australia? How did that happen?
I was walking, so I had met this woman a long time ago, seven years ago, and I bumped into her, so I didn't know her and I knew a bit about her. Her name was Naomi. I didn't know that. Couldn't remember that. And then this is going to sound fateful and strange, and I told this at my wedding and a lot of people said stalker,
so far that seems to be the way you've achieved everything else. It's just stalked Edmund Hillary, stalked your first job in Australia. I mean, it seems to be a successful strategy. Success with stalking, that's your second book after Work Well and God. I've Got No Fucking Idea.
I met her, and then 6 years later, one Saturday, I thought about her. Woke up in the morning, not in a drawing pictures or googly or type thing, but I just thought about this woman. And I remember her saying to me that she lived in Broadway, like around Broadway. That was 6 years ago, so she could have moved and whatever. For some reason, I went to Broadway. I said, I'm going to go see. I went to Broadway. I'll never forget it. I was walking by DeCosti's Fish and Chips, and I saw this tall woman from behind. I always joke that it was love at first from behind. She really fucking hates it. But,
I bet she does.
So I saw her and I literally just went whoop straight into the fish shop. She turned around. She saw me. I couldn't remember her name. And she reached out and said, hi, I'm Naomi. And I said, I'm Todd. And that's it. She walked away. And I remember thinking, she's the one. And then 3 years later, I wrote back with a diamond in my pocket to that fish shop. And she had no idea. And I got on my knees and I went to do the thing in the middle of the fish shop, but I should have warned them beforehand. She starts bawling her eyes out. Some guy thought I hit her. So he sort of comes shoving me and I'm looking up at her. Everyone's surrounding us in the fish shop. And I said, she's just crying. And I said, now would be a good time to say yes.
Yes.
And she said yes. And that's how we got. So that was 3 years relationship from DeCosti's to DeCosti's.
So because you say, that you knew then. Do you believe in that? And what is that, if that is a real thing?
No, I don't believe in that. But I did feel like I knew then. I don't believe that's a general thing. Do you know what I mean? But I it did happen to me. The thing that
Were you brought up with, did you feel like you were a person who wanted to find someone to get married to have kids? Like, was that something that you would have said was important, or at least if you don't have a plan, was in that sort of vague, that will happen at some stage?
I wasn't discouraged from that. Right. So I never really thought about it, but I wasn't like, I don't want to get married. Do you know what I mean? But I was not, I can't wait to get married type thing. Or that's part of my plan or anything. I was never thought about it.
And
like
as a person, would you describe yourself, were you lucky in love or unlucky in love when you were growing up until that point?
I just never really.
I don't need details. It's not war stories. But do you know what I mean? Like, do you feel like?
But I've never really thought about it. No, I'm neither of those. Like, it wasn't a big part of my life. Like relationships, I was so self-focused, mountaineering and all the stuff. I'd never really. Relationships were always tangential to me, to my life.
No, it's hard to say to somebody, "I'm in Nepal for 3 months. Could you please feed the cat?"
I've tried. Yes. Yeah. But you asked about how do you know. The only thing I know is that for a lot of people that I met through my life, I related to them. I use kind of a tree analogy. Like I've related to them at the branch analogy. Like we either catch up from work or we know each other. But with her, for some reason, not that the tree top of the tree thing didn't work, but we definitely related at that level, like at a root level. Root level sounds terrible, but she was
in Australia. It's
it's at a rooting level. Yes. Her family was a very rich, wealthy family in Burma, and one day the government came and took everything. So they were kicked out of the country. Naomi's family came here with $35, and they struggled in Canberra, for 30 years of her life or whatever. And so I somehow related to that. I kind of felt like I met someone who gets me, I don't have to explain it. Like, and she knows a bit and then she gets it.
Right.
As opposed to never going to get it. Right. And I think that, I don't know if that's the foundation of a great relationship, but at least I felt less like alone. Like I felt like I didn't have to explain it. She just got it.
And what about having kids? Was that something that that you thought, okay, now we're going to have kids? Or was that something that just kind of, again, in that way that you just keep living your life and then it sort of naturally happened?
Yeah, it's a keep living thing. Like I always avoided thinking about it because of climbing. And then when I met Naomi, we suddenly started to talk about it. And then it just became a bit of a reality. But no, I never really thought.
That's a good message for anyone listening. If you want your kids to not be knocking someone up, get him interested in climbing.
Do you know what my mother did to my sister, which I thought was brilliant? She showed her childbirth when she was young on TV.
Oh,
and my sister didn't want to have sex for a decade.
Well, that's the equivalent of like the dad locking you in the cupboard and making you smoke all the cigarettes, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it.
So, okay, so you have children.
Two girls. I've got a 7-year-old Coco and a 4-year-old Jet.
Does that make you change your mind about life when you have children? I mean, people say that it does. Do you feel like it did to you?
It makes you change your mind about money. That's the real thing it does.
And so what do you mean by that?
Well, it starts to become where you start to think about providing for them more. You start to think about what are they going to need? What are they going to need? Because we don't need much to really live our lives. But suddenly you start to think that they're going to need a lot. But no, it didn't really change my life.
Are you worried though, even with the money thing, how do you deal with that idea of you've just sat here and told me that you and your wife are the people that you are because of the struggle that you had to get to where you be. And I'm sure you think that is part of the reason you have been successful. Like, how do you then balance? Because your kids are not going to be in that same situation unless you make a lot of terrible decisions between now and when they're in high school. But you know what I mean? Like, is that something that you guys talk about? Is it something that you think, is an issue?
Yeah, well, it's going to be an issue because Naomi is more give them everything, but she's saying, oh, we need to make sure that we provide for their university and maybe one of a house and all the stuff. And I'm like, I don't want to provide any of that.
No.
And she's like, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I want them to figure it out. Like, I would be completely cool if they decided they didn't even want to go to university. If they decided they wanted to do something else with their lives. Like, we have very different views where Naomi, as a parent, sees we have to provide everything for them. And I don't. I see all we need to do is kind of guide them up to the door and let them jump through it and see how they go.
But it must be a very difficult thing for parents, that one, because I'm a bit of the belief, but maybe it's just one of those self-fulfilling things or self-reassuring things where I'm, because that's what happened to me. I finished high school and my parents looked after me and I lived at home until I finished high school. And then I went away to university and I got a job and I paid for my education later.
So did you go away to university?
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's a big difference.
I went to Canberra. It was like that seemed like a good halfway between where I grew up in the country and a real city.
Yeah.
Like it eased me into
perfect,
it was like a gateway city.
Yeah.
That I just go to on the way to a real big city. And, because I grew up for 17 years on the road my dad was born on. So, like, you have to ease yourself into the big world at some stage. But I always think that, part of the reason I've been able to be successful in my career, because my career is a career where it's very easy to be lazy. Mm. Like, because you're your own boss. So you can do as little or as much.
When did you realize that you had the kind of talent, the gift? Like, when did you realize, because as a comedian, like, I just imagine it as the most fun, insecure career that you could ever have. Like, beyond television, because television, you can kind of fake it or you can get directed.
Right.
As a comedian, you're just exposed.
Yeah, no, look, I mean, the thing is, I think it's like if someone's lost weight or gained weight, you know, there's never a moment where you go, oh, right, now I'm that person, because I'm here every day. You know, every day I reevaluate my thinking about, you know, what I'm doing based on whether I'm doing TV or whether I'm doing radio, or whether I'm tired or whether I'm at the start of the tour or the end of the tour. The thinking about the way that I do my job and what it means to me gets constantly reevaluated. But there was just a point. The point that I would say is there's two points where I was like, oh, okay. One was the day that I decided I was never going to do anything else. Like, I'd been doing it at that point for probably 5 or 6 years when I realized I was ruined for any other job. Like, you know, this was so much fun, and, you know, I had had so much fun doing it that I never wanted to, you know, I ran away and joined the circus, and I was never going to get a real job. And the second one was when I realized that I didn't mind sucking to get better, which came, I'm going to say, even maybe another five or, like, I'd been doing it probably 10 or 12 years before I really got to the point where it was more important to me to be better at it. Like, I was willing to go through the short-term pain and the short-term ego loss of sucking for a while,
yeah,
and taking a risk to do something that might suck in order to get better. And I reckon that was probably they're the two points where I'm like, fuck, I'm really locked into this. I hope this turns out well, because I have made either a great or a terrible decision. So I want to wrap it up. I could talk to you forever, and you know, we'll have to do another one at some stage and get to, you know, some of the other things. But I want to round it off, if I can, by talking about the idea of belief more generally. Do you believe that there is, like, are you guided by some sort of spirituality? Do you believe in God? Is any of that ever been a part of your life?
No, the only thing, and it's the only thing I'm going to teach my kids, and whether this is true or not, but at least scientifically makes sense to me, is karma. That's it. That's the only thing I've ever gone by. If the simplifying it down to, you know, you do good, you'll get good, you do bad, you'll get bad, you know, and that's the only thing I'll teach my kids. My kids will never step inside a church or a mosque or a temple unless they choose to, you know. But the only thing I kind of talk to them about is karma, because I believe that. I don't know if I believe it because I think.
Do you believe it on the level of it's an actual life force, or do you believe it on the level of that, you know, it's, you know, if you do something nice for someone else, by that very nature, the world is a better place.
That's it.
If you have that knock-on effect of, like, if you, you know, blast your horn at that dude in traffic who pulled out and didn't look, but nothing really bad happened, and then they are pissed off, so they take it out on the next person and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Sort of, you know, that we're giving and taking.
Yeah,
is that?
That's what I believe. Like, it's the universe around us that it's the kind of knock-on. And I also believe that, like, I've had an amazing life. Like, if I died tomorrow, I hope I don't, I would be, if someone said
I would be thrilled. I hope you don't either, but you as a marketer know what a boon this would be for my first podcast. Well, do you know what I mean?
Just don't set that up.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to
be walking out and somebody's a bag over my head.
It's not a stunt, but I'm just saying if you happen to die incidentally.
But if I did, I'd be extremely happy with everything I've done. Like, but I'm not a happy person. Like, I don't run around going, oh, Mr. Positive, but when you recap your life, like you just made me do, I look back and I think it is a combination of luck, a combination of talent in some areas, and just a combination of being where I am, you know, and giving it a go.
Being in the right place at the right time.
Place. And every time I think I said this right at the beginning, but I've faced a kind of life of adversity, but I don't look back at my life as the terrible life. I see all of those things as moments that I bounced off of in some ways and done something else. And
Do you think that this is do you think that you will keep going and changing careers and changing lives and doing things like that as you go on? Or do you see yourself going, okay, I really love this now, and this is something maybe I could do for the next, like, do you have thoughts like that?
Well, that's what the new documentary has done to me now. So it's bumped me in a whole different direction, you know, where I've done this documentary now.
Redesign My Brain, people in Australia can see on ABC iView if you haven't caught it yet, or Thursday nights at 8:30. There's one more episode to go. And if you're listening to this overseas, I assume it'll be available at some stage.
I don't know when. Discovery Channel, it looks like.
Oh, yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. It's a great show for that sort of thing. And I think you'll find that, I mean, I was actually talking to Justin Hamilton just this morning about this. We were taking the dog for a walk and we were talking about that show. And I was like, I could see you doing that, you know, 10 years of those. Like, you're such an excellent communicator, like in that area of people who want to watch something that's intelligent and they want to learn about the world, but they don't want to feel like they're being lectured to at the same time, you know, making it fun. That's really interesting, Todd. It's been, again, we could just keep talking, but I feel like, you know, this has been a good, I feel like we've got up until yes. now and then we can delve into it.
I'm feeling
it
lighter.
Do you feel like that?
Yes.
Do you feel like this has been, you've learned, have you learned something?
I've
Do you feel
something.
Like you've learned something?
You've patched together my life in a way that I haven't seen it.
Well, the interesting thing for me is like, I probably haven't talked about many of the things that, you know, people who were like, oh, I hope they talk about Gruen and what it's like or whatever. I don't know what people expect from this. But what I wanted to talk to you about was the things that I don't know about you, I guess. You know, like instead of the things that I do know about you, which I'm sure if we chat again will be things that we, you know, end up talking about. I wanted to kind of, you know, we've worked together for 6 years. This is a thing that people sometimes don't think as well. Like you and I, our lives are inextricably linked forever.
It's amazing, isn't
right?
it?
Right?
Yeah.
But we don't really, I mean, we see each other every week and we get on very well, but it's not like we get to sit down that often and have a chat. So that's why
this is one of the biggest chats we've had.
Yeah. I am only basically what people haven't worked out yet is I don't want to talk to anyone
outside this room
outside it being recorded and broadcast.
Oh, there you go.
I'm essentially like a dictator who just wants everybody to hear every thought and every conversation.
Could you hold that until I pull this mic out?
Yeah, Will's got a new podcast. Yes, he has. He just can. Anyway, okay, we're done. Thank you, Todd.
Cheers.